You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden, and our topic tonight will be Collaborative Courts 101. This segment compares and contrasts alternative models of criminal justice. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number to us right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're calling from outside of the local dialing area, please call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. Tonight, we're speaking with judges who have been leaders in this model of justice. In the studio with me tonight is retired Judge Eugene Hyman from Santa Clara County Superior Court. Judge Hyman is a longtime supporter and participant in Your Legal Rights here on KALW. And on the phone with us tonight is Judge Stephen Manley. Judge Manley brought mental health court and veterans court to the largest court system in the Bay Area. Unfortunately, my third guest, Judge Mark Forkum of the San Mateo County Superior Court, was unable to make it tonight. Also a long-term participant in the Your Legal Rights program, our thoughts and best wishes to Judge Forkum and his family. But let's begin. I'd like to welcome you, Judge Manley, Judge Hyman, to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'd like to start by inviting anyone who has an interest in criminal justice and this type of therapeutic model or other models to please feel free to call in. And this should be all of us. Again, the phone number to hear in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or from outside the area, that's 866-798-8255. I have lots of things I want to ask you both about and things that I would like to hear from you. But before I do, let me tell you, if you haven't heard it from me before, I come in as a big fan. As an attorney and a consumer of the justice system and seeing a lot of different models and a lot of different ways that judges approach cases, it's to me speaks volumes when you see the numbers of people that we throw lifelines to and how many of them pick it up and really turn their lives around. But before we get too far, let me ask both of you, just what type of model are we talking about? What is the system that we refer to generally as collaborative courts? Judge Manley, would you like to answer that?
Sure. Collaborative courts are basically started with drug courts years ago. And the idea is a pretty simple one, and that is that we should concentrate much more on getting good outcomes in terms of public safety and the life of the offender, as opposed to simply sentencing people and then ignoring them and not worry about the outcome in their future life. So a collaborative court basically consists of a judge and a team of professionals, and it's usually geared towards treatment or behavior change that will be necessary and productive in helping the defendant improving his or her life. And it meets on a regular basis. It is non-adversarial. That means, in simple English, it's not where lawyers are fighting with one another and the judge is ruling and overruling motions. It is a court in which everyone works together to try and help the defendant get a better outcome in terms of their lives. So it's for defendants, some of whom want a better outcome, and some of whom are resisting it but are willing to give it a try. And then these collaborative courts have to have treatment available to them and other services such as housing and drug testing and probation services and the like. And they have the offender come back, and we call those reviews, on a regular schedule. It can be every other week, once a month, depending on how well the defendant's doing, and they monitor the defendant's progress while participating in treatment. And that's just the bare bones of how a collaborative court works. There are many, many variations.
And that's true in both adult and in a juvenile model as well. Judge Hyman, would you like to comment a bit about that? I know you've done similar work in juvenile courts that basically follow the same program.
Well, certainly it does with respect to a juvenile drug treatment court, in which case everything that Judge Manley said is similar. Where there are some subtle differences, however, are with respect to domestic violence courts, which I believe also can be therapeutic depending upon how they're run. But a major difference is that people do not volunteer for a domestic violence court. If one exists, they're required to go through it. And secondly, it's totally adversarial. There can be a team approach to the court, but ultimately it's the judge that makes the decision, which is much different than a drug treatment court, where it's really a team approach in terms of discussing how to intervene. But the mechanisms are very different with respect to people that have drug problems versus those that have violence problems that may also have drug problems and mental health problems and other co-occurring problems.
Would you like to contrast for us the difference between perhaps a restorative justice model and a therapeutic jurisprudence model? And I'd leave that open for whichever of you like to answer. Judge Manley?
Well, you go ahead, Judge Hyman.
Well, restorative justice is used a lot with respect to juvenile delinquency. And a restorative model is most of the time in juvenile, it is pre-charging. In other words, certain cases, a probation officer with protocols decides that certain kinds of cases are appropriate for being on a pre-filing and a pre-plea basis to be disposed of. There are accountability boards where the juvenile appears with parents as well as the victim, and the juvenile, it's explained in terms of how the juvenile's behavior impacted the victim. With respect to if it's a felony, then by law, the district attorney has to be involved and has to be okay with a non-filing option. And it's restorative in the sense that there is more of a talking and more of a resource with respect to school being part of the solution, as compared to domestic violence, even involving juveniles in Santa Clara County. It's going to be petitioned, providing that the district attorney is satisfied that they're going to be able to prove their case beyond the legal standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. So in juvenile, at least, there's really a combination of restorative and therapeutic models that are used with respect to adjudicating these kinds of cases.
In an adult model, is that a fair contrast as well, Judge Manley?
Yes, I mean, particularly the fact that there is not adversarial atmosphere. I mean, the issue does, of course, come up. I have a very large mental health or behavioral health treatment court. And we are sent a large number of domestic violence cases. So the issues do come up relating to protections of victims, restitution, and similar issues. And the approach is to restore to the victim. This happened today. I mean, it's public knowledge. Because it's on the record, but that you are not going to complete the program until restitution has been paid, because there was a victim in the particular case. Now, in many other cases, there is no victim, but there is always a public safety issue. So, to me, the distinction between what is called restorative and what is called therapeutic doesn't have that much meaning. I think they both are designed to do to reach similar outcomes. In other words, public safety and rehabilitation of the offender should be at the forefront. And if you keep those at the forefront, whether you run a program that you call therapeutic or rehabilitative or whatever, restorative, you're still working along the same lines to try and reach the same outcomes.
And from my perspective, perhaps I live in San Francisco and my car has been broken into a few times. What does this mean to me? Why do I have an interest in our expending resources to these systems really designed to make the offender whole? What does this all mean to me?
Well, I mean, my answer is the following. We have seen an increase in property crime, and I think many people do not fully understand the effects of drug addiction and continued drug use in the criminal justice system, because often we focus on simply drug use. We do not understand or pay attention to the fact that, in, for example, in my county and in other counties, other cities throughout the United States, there are programs that test the individual when they come in and are booked. They are guaranteed the test results will not be used against them, and they test positive for being under the influence of drugs or alcohol. In my view, it is drugs and alcohol that, to a great extent, drive the criminal justice system. And unless you go to the root problems, the auto thefts will increase. They will not decrease. People will be less safe if we don't get to the bottom line, and that is people who are struggling because of mental illness, drug addiction, need to be rehabilitated, because if we can eliminate that driving force to commit crime, we will go a long way from where we are today. And that is why I say public safety is so important in these programs, because the average person does not want their car broken into. And when you look at arrest rates, and you look at criminal records of individuals who are involved in theft cases alone, about, I would say, roughly 30% of the cases I have, individuals, they have been convicted of theft cases. They all use drugs. And so if we can eliminate part of the driving force, or the causation, or whatever one wants to call it, to committing crime, we are making a headway and a good start to trying to change the entire system so that we will really get to the point of addressing recidivism and the repeated commission of crimes.
So this isn't a means of giving somebody a slap on the wrist instead of more serious consequences, but rather this is a means of getting us all safe by reaching the underlying causation when the circumstances that person bring to the table, or perhaps the crime they're accused of, warrant it.
Yes, exactly. Well, what I have come to believe firmly is that we have given a misnomer to collaborative courts. We call them treatment courts, feeling good courts, hugging the judge courts. What we ought to be talking about is accountability courts. Because if you go to any collaborative court, what they are really doing, if they're doing a good job, is holding the defendant accountable for their behavior and accountable to stop using drugs. And as they do that, they are basically improving public safety. And so it's sometimes there's a perception that these collaborative courts are feel-good courts where the only person that anybody cares about is the defendant. In other words, the person convicted of stealing the car is the only one that the judge cares about. And that's not the issue to me. The issue to me is we want to have less auto theft. And we're only going to get there if we start working on the root causes of why individuals continue to commit crime after crime while they continue using drugs. What if we can stop the drug use? And my view is, and research supports it, that if we can make inroads in stopping the drug use, we will reduce the crime rate.
Now, from my own experience, I know you keep people on a fairly tight leash in most of these courts. Most of these courts, they come back fairly often. They're working closely with legal professionals. When somebody gets convicted or arrested for a crime, while they're already in this process, does it typically result in them being excluded?
Never in my program. And the reason is this. It's very simple. As I said, if you're not working at the root problem, you're not getting anywhere. Now, if the person gets rearrested for a new offense, I never hear that case. That case goes before another judge. That judge decides the punishment. And when that is over with, the defendant comes back as a condition of probation or supervision to participate in my programs. So that defendant has been held accountable by another judge for the crime, and we are now back to working on the basic problem, which is you have to change your behavior. You have to learn, and it's not easy, how to stay sober, how to stay away from the people that are constantly impressing you on how important it is to continue committing crimes. It's basically people, places, and things that we find again and again and again with offenders in collaborative courts that end up causing them to continue the lifestyle they were living before they came to you. So if you give up on them at the first failure, you're going to get nowhere. And as a matter of fact, you reinforce the negative behavior because you're saying, you are a thief, and you're a drug addict. You are supposed to be working on staying sober and stop stealing. Now you have stolen again, so now I will deny you any help in stopping using drugs and learning how to stop stealing, which we might do well through cognitive behavioral therapy. In other words, you have failed. And when you give that message to people, we know from research that what they do is continue the same behavior. So that's one of the greatest problems I have with the people that appear before me.
If I understand you correctly, what you're saying is that rather than kicking them out of the program, or rather than giving them a pass because they're in the program, what you're saying is that the sanction ultimately is decided by the judge who decides their new case. What you've done is to hit the pause button, in essence, on the treatment court. Let them complete the court process for their new offense. Let them pay the penalty, whatever that penalty may be. But then they come back and pick up where they left off.
Exactly. There is no easy out. And the defendant needs to learn that. Because once they get clear that you're never getting out of this until you make some changes in your life, they start to change. And it's amazing. And I mean, I've been doing this for over 20 years. And every day you see people that you would never have predicted could change, actually do. But it is not easy, and it takes time and patience. And unfortunately, they do continue to commit crime. But we live in denial if we say they don't, that there's some magic bullet that we can give them, you know, send them to treatment and they'll never commit a crime again. I mean, that's utter nonsense. So we have to understand that human behavior that is negative, that is what is often referred to as criminal thinking, that can all be changed. That's what we call a dynamic factor. We can't change the fact that you started committing crimes when you were 15 and you're now 25. That's all gone. We can't change it. What we can change is, are you going to keep committing crimes? And that's the dynamic part of all of this that collaborative courts need to work on. And unfortunately, too often, they've gotten stuck in this well, we just do drug offenders, and we only give them one chance. And if they fail, we kick them out. And what that is cherry-picking. Because the only people that succeed are the people that would have succeeded without you. They don't need a judge who holds them accountable. They could have figured this out on their own. You know, there's enough negative factors from being in a criminal court that they will change their behavior without the necessity of being monitored. What we in collaborative courts have to work on is these hard and difficult cases, because they pose the greatest threat to the public are offenders who keep committing crimes. And so the word accountable, I think, is the most critical word we need to get in our vocabulary in the courts. That is that the judge is responsible for the defendant doing a better job in the community than they did before. In other words, I hold myself accountable to the best I can. And the way I do that is I look at what is my success rate, what is my failure rate, are people not getting rearrested for 5 years, 4 years, are they really making changes in their lives, and at the same time I have to hold the defendant accountable. Are you paying restitution? Are you leaving the victim alone? Are you doing what another judge ordered you to do? And so there are two levels of accountability, but I think in both of them we've kind of taken a pass. And we say, all I do as a judge is just sentence people, and then it's not my problem, it's society's problem.
I want to circle back to that. I can see Judge Hyman's been trying to... There's something that's been aching to say, and I see another call coming in too. But I do want to come back to that in a moment, and I want you to be thinking about recidivism and what measures we have for accountability. And right before I turn to Judge Hyman, I want to remind people, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. For those that have joined us late, we're speaking with Judge Eugene Hyman and Judge Stephen Manley from the Santa Clara County Superior Court. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number to us in the studio, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or if you're calling from outside the local area, 866-798-8255. And Judge Hyman, I see you've been trying to say something. Go ahead.
Thank you. First of all, I agree with everything that Judge Manley has said with respect to his expertise, with respect to drug treatment courts, and with respect to mental health courts, veterans courts, and the other kinds of courts that he presides over. My expertise predominantly is in the area of domestic violence, both with respect to juvenile and with respect to adult. And as I said earlier, the domestic violence therapeutic courts are completely 100% adversarial. That said, that doesn't mean that there can't be a component of therapeutic. I happen to believe that domestic violence courts can be very therapeutic. The research indicates that approximately 70% of batterers at the time of the battering have a substance in them, and probably 50% of victims have a substance in them at the time of a domestic violence incident. One of the things that I think that domestic violence courts are not as effective as they should be or could be is in the area with respect to intervention, with respect to substance abuse. I'm not talking about Santa Clara County. I'm not talking about any particular county. I'm talking about my experience with respect to how domestic violence is intervened within the various kinds of domestic violence courts within the United States. I don't think they're addressing substance abuse issues as effectively as they might, and I think in certain areas of the United States, I don't think that drug treatment courts are intervening as effectively as they might with respect to domestic violence issues. There are some that think that if a person becomes clean and sober, that domestic violence will stop. I think it's imperative that those that are batterers, or anyone for that matter, needs to become clean and sober, no question about it. But that isn't going to stop in and of itself in my opinion, domestic violence events. One of the important things with respect to domestic violence courts is by having reviews very similar in nature to reviews that are held in drug-related courts, is to make sure the person's completing their intervention program. And in the event that they don't, that there are appropriate sanctions in order to get them to complete the program. One of the concerns with respect to a domestic violence court is that if an individual violates a protection order or an intervention order, then that's a real safety issue, and there will be consequences for that. But as long as the person is on probation, they continue to participate. The only way that a person would not be participating in a domestic violence court is if they're sentenced to prison or if the defendant refused probation. Otherwise, they're participating whether they want to or not. And hopefully, the judge is an encouragement factor in terms of recognizing when the person is making positive strides and encouraging and holding accountable when they don't. This process, the research suggests that unfortunately a very high percentage of batterers will again batter. But when they begin this battering, to a certain extent, is dependent upon whether or not they complete the program. Now, in California, it's a 52-week program. And so when you consider that a person in a domestic violence court has to complete the statutory required 52 weeks, plus if they have substance abuse, and there's a good chance that that's present, then they have to deal with that, plus parenting without violence and any other kind of programming that might be necessary. And if you consider the possibility of mental health issues, one has to be careful not to overprogram someone, in which case if they are, then it's the increasing likelihood that they're not going to be successful.
And when you mean overprogram somebody, you're talking about giving them too many conditions so that they can't hold down their job because they're going to too many classes, and basically you're preconditioning them to fail.
Correct. And that's a real problem. That's why you have to have specially trained probation officers that are able to assist the person. I mean, you need probation officers that are really part social worker and part law enforcement officer. And a lot of probation officers nowadays want to be a police officer, and the social work side of it. But a lot of these people, just like in Judge Manley's court, they need they might need an inpatient drug treatment program. They might also need assistance with respect to getting a job or assistance with respect to not being homeless. So, you know, all these things present additional challenges that are very frustrating. You know, when a person completes the 52-week program, they're acknowledged, but there aren't celebrations. There isn't the constant clapping and that kind of celebration. That doesn't happen in a domestic violence court. There certainly is positive acknowledgement, but at the same time, it's also acknowledged in terms of what the defendant did to wind up in a domestic violence court. And it wasn't just because of a mental health issue. It was because they affirmatively battered someone, and this is part of the consequence. Not that it has to be a put down, but there also needs to be a seriousness to it, in the sense that in the event that they violate rules, there will be immediate consequences and immediate sanctions.
Howard, I know you're holding on the line. We'll be with you in just a moment. And Judge Manley, we're going to break for just a moment, and we'll be right back to your legal rights. We'll be back with you just right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
Howard from Alameda, you've been very patient. Thank you for waiting, and you are live on Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. It's an interesting discussion, but I'm just wondering, it seems to me that drugs are so illegal, drugs are so expensive because they're illegal, and because they're considered, it's considered a crime problem, not a medical problem. Drug addiction, like alcohol addiction, is a medical problem. So why don't we treat it that way? Wouldn't that solve the problem of high prices and jails and everything else? Thank you.
Howard, thank you for that. And I'll turn that question to Judge Hyman. Judge Manley is, as a sitting judge, probably not in a position to really speak to policy, although if you feel you're comfortable answering it, I'd be happy to turn it to you.
Well, you know, the legislature decides what the law is. I mean, I can pontificate in terms of various ways to intervene. I personally don't think that the drugs ought to be made legal, and I think the legalization of marijuana, we're going to be finding out relatively soon in terms of the consequences that we're all going to be facing as a result of that, with driving under the influence and other kinds of difficulties. You know, we don't make the law. We follow it as best as we can. And while the caller has a good question, I think that's something that has to be addressed to the legislature. That's not something that we can handle.
Judge Manley, when we were speaking before the break, you had mentioned about accountability. And one of the things that comes to mind is measures of recidivism. Do you have any feedback on whether this system works? Are people more likely to reoffend when they've completed a program in the drug court or the mental health court or some of the other collaborative courts we discussed, as opposed to those that are simply punished in a more traditional model?
Well, there's no question there's been, you know, 10 to 20 years of research that shows that offenders who complete a collaborative court program, a drug court, behavioral health, mental health, veterans court, the recidivism rate is much lower than the control group, which is the group of similarly situated defendants who don't participate in any sort of treatment court. So there's strong evidence of that fact, and based on that, these courts continue to be funded by Congress and by the state, because they see as you make strides in reducing recidivism, you want to keep that program alive and going. We know that the other approach, which is to simply punish, has done nothing to reduce recidivism, and it has cost the taxpayers billions. I mean, our state prison system costs nearly as much, as if not more, than all of our state colleges. And, you know, there's a repeated effort to reduce recidivism and to reduce the population of the state prisons. And more is coming to local alternatives, and that's based on voter initiatives and actions by the legislature over the last few years. And I think that's a very positive sign that we're going in the right direction. In other words, we fail going the other way. And it's, as Judge Hyman said, it is entirely a policy decision. Judges do not make policy decisions. However, we do supervise and monitor offenders. And if we find something that works, such as collaborative courts, then we need more of them, not less of them. And we need to continue this grand experiment that is proving to be very successful in reducing recidivism. And that to me is just something that every court hopefully will come to accept over time, and we will see more of these courts rather than fewer.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. We're speaking tonight with Judge Stephen Manley and retired Judge Eugene Hyman from the Santa Clara County Superior Court. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. 4134. If you're calling from outside of the local dialing area, please call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. There's a number of different types of collaborative courts. Judge Hyman, you were listing them before. In addition to the drug court model, which we've all heard about, you mentioned mental health court or domestic violence court. What types of courts would you consider collaborative and working off the same model?
Well, I would be rather liberal with respect to being descriptive of that. I think whenever you have a situation where people are working, where there's a core group of collaborative partners that are working toward a reduction of crime and a increase in terms of rehabilitation, an increase in terms of accountability, I would consider that to be collaborative. I don't think that it has to be limited just to domestic violence or limited just to something involving alcohol and other drugs. It can be, you know, any kind of a problem. So in your situation, the description that you gave earlier with respect to auto break-ins, I mean, San Francisco, which has a huge problem in this area, could have a special auto break-in calendar where they could deal with just people with that kind of problem in terms of from a caseload management standpoint. I'm sure that if you studied it, there'd be some commonalities besides the fact that everyone that's doing it has a substance abuse problem. They might have other commonalities in terms of difficulties that there might be a collaborative approach to. But getting back to what Judge Manley was talking about, see, I would expand not only the types of collaborative courts, but I'd also expand eligibility. For example, depending upon the county that you're in some counties, if you have for lack of a better term, bindles or whether it be meth, whether it be heroin, whether it be cocaine, whatever, you might be charged possession for sale. In some counties, you might not be. In some counties, you might be eligible to participate in a drug treatment court. In some counties, you'll be prohibited from participating in a drug treatment court because you'll be deemed to be possession for sale. I think we need to be expanding, looking at the background of the individual. So if a person who has four items and they're selling three in order to support themselves with the fourth one that they're basically paying for by selling the other three, then that person really isn't acting from the standpoint of selling to be an entrepreneur. That person is selling predominantly from a survival mechanism, and I think that person would benefit from participating in a drug treatment court. But in many counties, or even most counties, they're going to be prohibited from doing so. So I think we need to expand how people can participate. And by doing that expansion, it doesn't necessarily mean that at the end of the day, a case is dismissed or is even reduced. There are other ways of rewarding people for their participation, and I think we need to be expansive in terms of how we do that.
So, as I understand it, you're suggesting that for somebody who may be a little on the side to support their usage, we might treat them a little differently than somebody who may just use a little bit or dabble a little bit in what's, in essence, a business enterprise to sell.
Exactly.
Judge Manley, do you find that that would run afoul of the grants that often run these programs?
No, we receive substantial grants. There are grant conditions that relate. They reflect really the thinking 20 years ago, and they have not been changed. Not much in terms of these fundamental laws that were put in place to create or funding mechanisms for collaborative courts. Not much of those have changed, but the most recent ones are dramatically changing and allowing drug courts, mental health courts to take individuals charged with crimes of violence, possession cases for sale, things of that nature. I've never found it to be a problem, because if you tie your funding to a specific calendar that fits that funding, rather than trying to put everyone in your program and then add a little of this funding that has a lot of restrictions on it. And we've never had a problem with that. I mean, we've been taking for years and years those who are charged with possession or possession for sale of drugs, transportation for sale, sales of drugs. I think, you know, the question really is, as Judge Hyman pointed out, many people possess an amount of drugs that would be considered for sale because they are supporting a habit. There are some people that are dealers. Now, how do you make that distinction? Well, if you run a good collaborative court, in my view, that decision is not made by a judge like myself, similar to myself, who is the collaborative court judge. It's made through the adversarial system. And in that way, you obtain the buy-in of the district attorney, the prosecution, as well as the defense, as well as probation, because they all sit down and come to a conclusion that this person needs to be punished, yes, but after that, you need to stop the drug use. And so that person will be referred for a treatment court, not as an easy way out or a lighter sentence, but as a necessary condition of probation. You see, again, it goes back to where I started. Even if the person is dealing drugs, they are going to be using them too. I see this every day. But it is not the majority of my caseload. I mean, there's been a dramatic change in that.
Let's talk about that for a moment. You mentioned a change in the caseload, and I want to circle back to that. I should probably give our viewers a chance, our listeners a chance to call in if you like. Our number here, questions from my guest, is 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You were mentioning about some of the more modern issues, and we were talking before we went on the air about some of the problems that are currently facing the collaborative court, some of the changes in law. I've been practicing for long enough to know that when these collaborative courts started, there tended to be a bigger stick and more incentive for people to enter the courts. Do you find that there's been a drop-off in participation since some of the more minor offenses, the drug offenses and the like, don't have the same penalties attached to them as they once did?
Oh, certainly. I mean, that's well established that when the voters, the legislature, those who make policy, change that policy, there's really less incentive for anyone to participate in a drug court, for example. And that the thing that frustrates me is that is something one should be able to see clearly. And then that doesn't mean you eliminate the drug court. It means that drug court takes those individuals who commit other crimes and are driven to a great extent by nonstop drug use and starts putting them in treatment and rehabilitation rather than going back to the punishment model. So that if there is no punishment anymore, yes, there is less incentive for anyone to enter a drug court, but that is a general problem that we all must face. And the fact that there's a less incentive does not mean you should quit trying. Drug courts are really designed to take those individuals who are at the highest risk to reoffend, so that's the public safety side of it, and have the greatest treatment needs. And you can easily find those individuals in the criminal justice system, regardless of whether the crime that they commit is a possession of drug crime as opposed to an auto theft. That person is going to be there, and it to me, it's a cop-out for drug courts to say, well, we're not going to stay in business any longer because we can't offer any incentives and we don't have any way to sanction the person when they don't do what we ask them to do. In other words, the defendant is in charge of the court system, of the drug court, rather than the judge. And I think that's the wrong way to look at it. You shouldn't be working with people where there is no incentive. I mean, it's unfortunate, but again, as the caller pointed out, there is a coming to be a much stronger view. Again, this is a policy decision. Judges don't make this. That we should be moving towards a system that is a public health system and not a criminal justice system. And if that's a policy decision, then the courts must accept it. It is not up to us to tell the legislature or the voters that they should have a different system than what they want. However, that being said, it doesn't mean that there isn't an incredible amount of work to be done by collaborative courts. And the great issue in my mind is the fact that they don't take enough people. We don't have enough offenders who need this help and this strict accountability system in these courts. They are very small courts instead of very large courts. And that, to me, is a question of judicial resources. It's complex. It's a question of the willingness of the prosecution and the defense to participate, probation and so forth, all the stakeholders. But they are the same stakeholders who said 20 years ago, we won't participate in drug courts, you see? It's to me, it's a question of our all getting better at doing what we do and not take the time to live in the past. We can't. It's not going to change until the legislature or the public change it, and that may not happen. So why don't we live with what we have and do a good job in terms of putting offenders into this program? And I would just add one other thing that I think there is an overemphasis on this notion of sanctions, that you must have a big stick to do a good job with offenders. Now, I have a very large court, and nearly all of my offenders are mentally ill. And I can guarantee you, from my experience, speaking only for myself, sanctions are very useless to me. They don't really help. What does help is incentives. And we have spent too much time arguing about we don't have enough sanctions without talking about how good a job we can do if we improve the incentives.
Our history of using the stick rather than the carrot.
Right. Drug courts are used to, judges are always used to using the stick. I mean, that's a great advantage to a court. But to me, what research shows is that for every sanction, you should give 5 to 6 incentives if it's going to be effective.
Have them give examples.
Can you give an example of some of those incentives?
Sure. You've already, I think Judge Hyman mentioned one. Find someone housing. Housing is one of the most crucial areas that we are missing in the courts. We do not have the housing for these offenders, and we need to find it. So if you can get an offender into housing, if you can then get an offender a job, if you can get an offender a situation in which they feel better about themselves, do it through a job training program, through going to school, through not having to come to court as often, by lessening the conditions of probation. Judge Hyman talked about domestic violence. You cannot expect a defendant who's mentally ill to do a domestic violence program, a mental health program, a drug and alcohol program, see a probation officer, and come to court every other week. They just can't do it. So you got to use common sense and start out with what can they do. And that is an incentive. In other words, you are building them up by saying, okay, we'll put other things on hold. Stay away from the victim. and do this part of your program first. Then when you finish that, we move to the next one. Now you may say, well, that's just a common sense way to do it. No, you're giving an incentive, because as the offender completes one part of his program or her program, that is a victory to them. You praise them, and we know from studies that a judge's praise of a defendant is far more effective than throwing the defendant in jail for 3 days because they screwed up. Praising them for doing little things is more effective than punishing them for not doing big things, you know, which to them are beyond their comprehension and abilities until you build them up. So that, to me, is what an incentive system is all about. It's not that complicated. It's just you have to be focused on it, that that's really what you're working on.
Judge Hyman.
Yes, I totally agree with everything that Judge Manley has said. I really liked when he was talking about expanding the eligibility, expanding the base of people that could be participating, and coming up with appropriate rewards for their participation. One of the concerns I have is the number of people. Again, I'm not talking about Santa Clara County or any particular county, just certain areas of the state where, well, gee, it's only a misdemeanor, feeling that that somehow the police are not taking it seriously, or that the prosecution is not taking it seriously, or that the court is not taking it seriously. You know, judges take, as a general rule, take all crime seriously, as they should. I mean, if a case has been filed on, if it's brought before the court, then the court has to deal with it. Now, I certainly appreciate that in certain parts of the state, there's a problem with jail space, that if you receive a year in certain counties, you're going to do a week or maybe a little bit longer. And on the other hand, in Santa Clara County, if you're given a year, you're gonna do the year less your credits for good time work time. And I think it's important, while I certainly appreciate what Judge Manley is saying with respect to rewards and with respect to praise, I think it's critical in any kind of a therapeutic or restorative court that there has to be praise, especially from the judge. I think there also has to be the availability, should it be necessary, to be able to use the appropriate sanction if nothing else has been working, and that there needs to be jail space available, and that, you know, that if a person is to receive a sentence, a lawful sentence by a judge, that it be carried out. And in too many parts of the state, that isn't possible for a number of different reasons. Also, I think it's helpful with respect to people who are misdemeanors where there is a drug problem behind it, whether it be for possession or being under the influence, or whether it be petty theft or whatever, that if the court can't provide the supervision in terms of having people come back, that there be hopefully funding for probation to do the testing and other kinds of things that are required, and that in the event of failures to comply, that there be appropriate sanctions. I'm not suggesting that we lock all people up, because the bottom line is we cannot incarcerate ourselves out of crime. People have tried. It doesn't work. And the other kinds of policies and procedures that Judge Manley has put into place with respect to Santa Clara County, and that he's taught throughout the United States, work. And there's no question in my mind that lives have been saved, numerous lives have been saved, money has been saved as a result of collaborative drug treatment courts and their brothers and sisters and cousins in terms of other kinds of courts. The number of people that have been saved from foster care, having to go into foster care, which is extremely expensive, not to mention the costs of incarcerating. You know, it's not free. But there's all these competing partners that want money for what they do, that's competing with resources for beds. But we ought to be thinking about ways in terms of expanding the use of these courts and expanding treatment and expanding interventions, because they work, and there's plenty of studies to prove it.
In the end, isn't it always come down to a question of balance? While in our larger society, the pendulum swings are getting wider and wider, but in this model, we're looking at a question of balance. When to use the carrot, when to use the stick, when probation is supervisory or even acting as police, or when they're acting as social workers and really being supportive. Ultimately, there's a place for both. And keeping it measured and using the appropriate amounts of each, isn't that really what we're talking about?
Yes, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, the key word is measured. As I say, I mean, I use sanctions, but what we have learned, and what I personally have learned over time is that we used to have sanctions work this way. If you tested dirty, in other words, you're using drugs still, all right, the first time you do 5 days in jail, the second time 10, the third time 30 days, and we keep escalating up. Well, you keep using drugs, and pretty soon you're talking about 5 years. What we have learned is that the sanctions that work are short. Short, they have to be to the point. The offender has to be sanctioned immediately, not 5 months later. And there has to be a purpose to it. I mean, what are we changing here? What are you expected to do as a result of it? Those sanctions work. And the other thing that most people who do this work don't really understand when you work with very high needs and high risk offenders, they often sanction themselves because they end up in jail again for new offenses, because they don't come to court. You know, these are things that in and of themselves are sanctions, wake-up calls, reminders of how you need to change. So I've just learned that you need to be measured, as you said, that you have to be on an even keel with not overdoing sanctions, and most certainly realizing that you need far more incentives than sanctions.
And as I learned from working with juveniles, immediate sanctions are more effective, but you also don't want to keep the incarceration period unnecessarily long to where they develop a comfort level. You want to disrupt what they have going, give them something to think about, but you really want to get in and get out quickly. We have just a couple moments left. Do you want to take about a half a minute each to bring up any last points that you have? Judge Manley?
Go ahead, Judge Hyman. Oh.
Judge Hyman? You're each pointing in the other direction. I've had co-defendants who do such things, pointing to one another.
Well, I mean, my comment is that I really think that we need to change the way we approach criminal justice in terms of the courts and in terms of our collaborative courts. I think we have to recognize where we are today and be willing to accept the responsibility to work with the more difficult offenders. The population in our jail has dramatically been decreased over the last few years. There are still individuals in that jail who do not need to be there if they were in a system that gave them rehabilitation that was real and accountable. And I think we have to work towards that goal instead of sitting back and saying, policy has changed, therefore we have no responsibility.
Judge Hyman, last words?
I sound like I'm, you know, a parrot or something, but I agree with Judge Manley. I think we need to expand. The only possible exception is with respect to domestic violence. Some of these people are extremely violent, and we need to have the jail sanction needs to be available for when they violate protection orders, restraining orders. And there's children involved, usually, and this adds to the concern. And these are scary people.
Thank you. That'll be the last word on the subject. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. My guests tonight have been Judge Eugene Hyman and Judge Stephen Manley from the Santa Clara County Superior Court. Thank you both for joining us. We'll be back next week with Your Legal Rights, where we'll be discussing the evolving treatment of mental health within the system of criminal justice. Our thanks to you for listening, to our production assistant, Martin McLean, and at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.